When did fairy stories end? Worldbuilding is said to formally begin around the time of Tolkien for most. But what about those early tales of trolls, fairies, elves, and curses? Let's talk about myth and fairy tale. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Worldcraft Club, a show for writers, storytellers, dungeon masters, and anybody else who wants to create rich, immersive settings for their audience to get lost in time and time again. I'm James, your host, and I'm joined today by usually producer Dave, who is now guest Dave, and last time you saw him was writer Dave. So Seth is playing producer for us today, and we are talking about myth and fairy stories. This is an interesting thing because we're talking a little bit about what would sort of amount to proto-world building, right? It's hard to find examples of world building that reach back way, 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 way far, but all of us can think of things like, the Brothers Grimm stories or old tales of trolls living under bridges. And there's something about those that caught people's imaginations and made them think about things further afield, though the process of world building itself didn't really take shape for some time after these stories, and that's putting it lightly. World building is sort of a recent innovation, so to speak. This really struck up Dave's imagination and got us both talking and thinking about the role that some of these early stories play in our current world building, and I think it's instructive to look at it. So, Dave, you've had some time to think about it. Heck, we've had a crack at this one before with AJ on a tablet, like on a chair.
The lost episode.
Yeah. May they never see the light of day. What are your thoughts like on kind of this origin, proto world building of fairy stories and myth?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, we're just doing the same things now that people used to do before in terms of telling these kinds of stories. But I think there's a divide, and it seemed to happen right at when Lord of the Rings was written.
Yeah.
That's probably putting too fine a point on it. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of validity to that argument. So we were actually, like, this came up through someone else on the server, Andy Zimba.
Yeah, yeah.
Who
writes out our Dalincourt, right?
Yes. Yes. And he and I got into a conversation about a post he had written.
Was it about allegory that he'd written? I didn't get a chance to actually read the post.
The original post was about Tolkien's impact on world building and the way that kind of ran into problems sometimes with people being like, well, your elves aren't very elvish. And what people were imagining was Tolkien's elves. Yeah. That's not like the only legitimate version of an elf, right?
Yeah.
That conversation just kind of, it went on and we worked out the math of how many elves there would be today.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like in the time that humanity went from 5 million to 8 billion, elves would have gone from 5 million to about 7.5 is where the math came out. And that was based on some real sketchy data that I scrounged up.
Yeah, they've got kind of the immortality, but they don't have the birth rate.
Like, right.
It's like they're not plowing elves out.
But just now that we've set the table. So what he said in the two of us talking back and forth is that he sees a divide between stories that are allegory and stories that are world building. And so the way he puts this, and I don't want to put words into his mouth, jump on the server if you're not on it already. And
ask him yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did Dave get this wrong?
And also you can look at the record. It's all there.
Yeah, there you go.
In black and white or white and black, depending on your phone settings. So he sees a difference between allegory versus world building. Yeah. Allegory is very simple world building. There's a troll under a bridge, and it doesn't matter why the troll's there. It doesn't matter why the government hasn't done something to get rid of the troll. It just matters that there's a troll there and it's an obstacle for our main character. So that's just an allegory. Like the troll is just an obstacle presented as a mythical creature.
Yeah.
And we talked about that some. He made some amount of caveat in his original statement about that there's sort of a sliding scale there. Because what he says on the other end is that the world building is a world that would also include, like, the world has a past and a present and a future.
Yeah.
Whereas with allegory, you're really just interested, like you're only interested in building the world enough to tell that particular story, I think is a way to put it. I think, again, that's a fair way to put it. And Steel Stash, another server member, jumped in there and he gave his two cents about it as well. And he kind of emphasized the sliding scale kind of point that like a world where there's a troll under a bridge is a very simple world. and it might not matter, so on and so forth, why people haven't done something about this troll before, etc. So I think that's, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that as it's particularly as a dichotomy, the whole allegory versus world building. But I do think it gives you an interesting point to start grappling with. And I think that it pointed out something to me, helped me kind of clarify a way I've maybe always sort of thought about it somewhere in the back of my head. But I think part of why we world build today versus the telling like the myths and fairy tales of yore is that back then people believed that if you went deep enough in the woods, you might find a troll.
Yeah.
We just don't believe that anymore.
Yeah.
Most of us generally, you know, you might.
Yeah,
Find some people, fair play.
Like, put it in the comments. Like, yes. we're like keen to find out.
Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, I think that plays a role.
Yeah.
I think also just the fact that like, I think part of what Tolkien did that sort of broke things, in a sense, like busted this all wide open, is that he was really creating a mythology, but he was setting out in some ways to create a mythology for Britain because Britain didn't have its own like a mythology to call its own.
Yeah,
he created this for that purpose. But in doing so, he created elves as like flesh and blood creatures.
Yeah.
So we think of them as needing to have things like birth rates. Whereas I think in a lot of your older fairy tales, and this is something that Tolkien talks about in his On Fairy Tales essay.
Yeah.
These are creatures from another world. Like there's one troll under the bridge because only one fell spirit like took the form of a troll to go sit under that bridge and taunt this town, maybe even this particular person, but we just don't buy that anymore. We're like, where's the rest of the trolls? Who is this troll's mom? And who is this troll's dad? And like all these questions that it's like, it doesn't matter. It's a monster. Like
yeah.
it's a demon
yeah.
that's taken.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe this is just putting like explicitly Christian overtones onto it. I don't think it is. It's something you see through a lot of religions and belief systems that like, a creature could come from another dimension or something of that nature. A creature could come from another plane and not have to be so grounded in biology and reality as to need things like birth rates and populations and a food source and all those kinds of things.
Well, Tolkien's elves sort of straddled that. You know what I mean? Like they mm-hmm. were mystical flesh and blood creatures, like
yes.
in a way, you know what I mean? Like there was a little bit of a lack of clarity. Like, I mean, Gandalf's a really good example of it. He's a physical manifestation in the form of an old man of a mire. Mm-hmm. And so like as is Sauron and Balrogs. And it's kind of like,
right. And the Ents are tree spirits.
Yeah.
Like they're more spiritual creatures than they are flesh and blood creatures, but they were also the Entwives. Like,
yeah.
So yeah, it definitely walked a line.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting thing. I think a lot of times, like a lot of fantasy, is a desire to sort of reclaim that lost wonder. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, we focus so heavily on this question of wonder and awe and mystery, is that I think really that is a lot of the role of world building. Because it used to be that, like, you know, if you look at locations of towns, there's like basically a 5-mile radius you can draw around mm-hmm. any given town, and you will find another town within that radius because that was the distance of a day's travel to trade for horse and cart. And this often occurs like in Pennsylvania. You can actually look around here. If you go in Britain, certainly, like it'll be the case. If your world is that small within that sort of 5-mile radius around town, really anything could kind of be happening beyond the sort of fog of war like around
yeah.
there. Like if you're familiar with strategy games, you'll have that kind of, you know, fog of war scenario where when it gets dark, it's like you don't see what's going on over there. And I think there was a sense of wonder about the world that has been lost. But I think we sort of know that, like, that feeling is almost necessary, I think, to some extent, to the human soul. And so we've kind of created a synthetic mystery and wonder
yeah.
in the form of stories to kind of keep that going now. And we need these broader worlds to sort of feed that desire. Not to get too metaphysical on this again.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the reality is the world is more wonderful and wacky than we often give it credit for being. Mm-hmm. There may not be trolls, you know, Sasquatch might not be out there, you know, I want to believe, you know,
yeah.
I want him to be, I hope. But like, I just actually had an article kind of come up on my phone and I gave it a look. I forget the exact title and all the other pertinent details, but the thrust of the article was that we have all these ideas about how fast the universe is expanding. And it all came from like the Hubble telescope. And like, we have all these, you just taught things as if that's the black and white way it is. Mm-hmm. And, but there's discrepancies in the data. And they're unsure about what caused it. The speed at which the universe is expanding isn't a constant thing as Hubble was measuring it. And yeah. I think I'm getting this right enough for my purposes here. Yeah. But the takeaway from the article is like the person they interviewed was like, you know, it's very exciting. It could just be that we have misunderstood the universe. And yeah. as someone that has more of a, I don't want to say like mystical outlook, but definitely a more spiritual outlook on the universe. I'm kind of like, yeah, you probably did. Like, I mean, yeah. I think we are so much closer to understanding the universe now than we were a long time ago in a lot of different metrics. But at the same time, there really is still a lot of wonder out there. And there's a concept in science that's always just kind of like, sort of made me chuckle. It's called like the half-life of knowledge. Where knowledge, just like a radioactive element, decays over time.
Yeah.
And stuff, like there's going to come a certain point where it's like only half the information that was in our science book textbooks are still believed. Yeah. There might be this kernel that's still going to be in there that's going to be consistent. But we do live in a world that's full of wonder and mystery. And so I think that's why we like these stories and why we want to experience that. I think maybe we want, on some level, to believe that there's a troll in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. It's one of the things that Seth and I had done when we kind of started this off is, again, like I've said this, you know, 1,000 times on here, but like we kind of started this off desiring to complain about bad world building as we saw it, right? Like single biome planets, all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And like things that were just sort of annoying to us in world building. And the more that we thought about it, the more we kind of went back to this question of what is world building really supposed to do? And I think recapture that sense of wonder is like a pretty big portion of the goal and objective of solid world building within a given system. And so it's interesting to start with these fairy stories and these myths because part of the excitement in them to some degree is they might be real. This might actually happen to you. You know, you need to be prepared in case you encounter a bridge troll. You know, I don't think a lot of
or at
just,
the very least, the woods are dangerous. Yeah. Watch your back in there.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like you don't know what you're going to encounter. And especially I think as people explore new lands or kind of pioneers in new places, that's, you know, you don't know if you're going to encounter a sapient old-timey bathing suit up in the Himalayas or whatever. Like you don't know what you're going to get. And it's like this idea that the world could just sort of throw a curveball at you. And I think over time, it's world building is sort of a side effect of the onset of materialism and ennui. And it's this idea that, well, no, the troll does have to have come from somewhere. You know what I mean? The troll cannot have been spontaneously erupting from malign spirits in the area of nondescript origin. Like it just has to have, you know, some lineage or history. I think increasingly I'm seeing world building actually go the other way now. I think particularly with like cosmic horror and other genres like that, where they're sort of being like, yeah, it's actually, you know, this stuff could just sort of materialize and we're just deal with it materializing. I think like Adventure Time kind of plays a bit of that sort of game where it's, does there need to be a reason for candy people? And then they're like, ah, cool. There's this thing called the Mother Gum that makes Princess Bubblegum. And it's real weird. And she has a brother who's like a dragon. Who like fell and hurt his head and got really sad. Like it's bizarre stuff like happens in that show. And they just gave up trying to explain it. I think there is a resurgence of that almost desire for the unexplained. It's going full myth into the way we're doing things. Yeah. Do you think you see that a little bit?
I'm not sure. I think there's been an interesting kind of back and forth between
his attention.
Yeah. And I don't know. Like, I feel I'm like grasping at what's been, what I've seen recently, you know, like how do I answer that question? What are some worlds I've seen built
about,
and
like,
how do they
themes and things like that, like, going through. It's hard to put a finger on it, but get a sense that we're approaching an era where there's a little bit of pushback to, I think, a purely materialist view of world building, that you have to establish the birth rates or it's not realistic. Or this idea of realistic in a world is, I think, being, I don't know if I want to say it's being like abandoned, but like agitated against a little bit. I'm seeing some of that in some of the, it's fringier stuff. You know what I mean? I don't think Adventure Time's for everybody, but like, it's definitely, I don't know. I just wonder if we're beginning to appeal to a desire for more mystery and myth. I'm just throwing curveballs at you right now.
Yeah.
I'm just like hitting you with all of it.
I don't know. I would be interested to see then if Lewis's stock goes up a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good thing to watch. Because honestly, Lewis is pretty bad world builder by most modern standards.
Yeah.
And I think Tolkien even called him out on
especially talking about allegory, right? Like, it's like flipping heck.
Yes, but I want to be a little bit pedantic about allegory, though.
Yeah.
Because Pilgrim's Progress is allegory.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you actually have characters that are named for what they symbolize.
Yeah.
Like, that's true allegory. And then I think you could move...
On the alignment
You move a lot further up the scale before you get to Lewis, who was definitely...
He
was definitely writing with it. Heaviest, obvious...
Chaotic allegory.
Yeah. Symbols and parallels. But the fact that the lion wasn't named Jesus maybe gives him just a tiny bit of leeway.
Like, there was this really good... It was a meme, right, that they had. And it was Tolkien sitting there saying, "Does the ring represent sin?" "Not really. I mean, I don't know. You could think about it." And it's a good long thing. And then it goes to Lewis and he goes, "I swear, if people don't realize Aslan is Jesus, I will light myself on fire." Like, it's just like...
Which you never would, because he was a good Augustinian. But I think Lewis was not much of a world builder in this modern sense. And I think that Tolkien's world, like his approach, is really what gave us world building.
Yeah.
And Lewis was a contemporary and a friend, but either didn't get exactly what he was doing or just said, like, "That's not what I'm trying to do."
Yeah. They had completely different approaches to fiction.
And I think I've been reading Chronicles of Narnia to my kids, and I've read some other Lewis, both his like fiction and his nonfiction. And the man can write.
Yeah. Yeah.
His prose is beautiful. And like the Space Trilogy, a little more aimed at adults, some of my favorite books, but doesn't have the popularity of Narnia. A lot of people think of Lewis, they think of Narnia.
Yeah.
And again, Narnia, it's not, if you're going there looking for a world where you can understand an entire, like the family tree of the satyrs and what are all these things doing here, then it's not going to deliver on that. But it really is an extremely well-written story.
And I think where I've kind of sat is because I did not read Narnia, and I have yet to read it. I have seen multiple adaptations of it, varying quality. I have not. The BBC one was amazing. This dude dressed in like huge paper mache furry thing. It's like, it's a beaver. But anyway,
been many years since I saw that one.
Pretty
legendary. If that's the one I saw.
I have strong recollections of it. But I always found in a lot of ways C.S. Lewis's world building, I think I fancied myself as almost too mature for it. I was like, I need more detail. I need more lineages. I need more written languages. I need to have more clarity on where these different characters come from. I can't accept that the queen just has a dwarf chilling there and that dwarf appears to have no formal identity or culture except that he's curmudgeonly, you know.
Yeah.
It's like that for me just always
plus
felt,
he's dressed like a gnome. He doesn't look like a dwarf at all.
He doesn't look like a dwarf at all. Like, he's supposed to protect
you did dwarves wrong, Lewis.
Yeah, just go back and protect your garden from witches like gnomes are supposed to do. That was like, he did a terrible job protecting from witches as I think about it.
Yeah, he had really fallen down on the job.
Corrupted gnome, that's what a dwarf is. But yeah, it's that thing. I remember this one time I had this conversation with this guy and I was like, you know what? I was playing Warcraft and their trolls are totally different. They're like these very long-limbed, skinny, like critters, and they're supposed to be like more agile and quick. They're a little bit elf-like in that way. Sort of the skill sets you would describe to an elf.
You'd call sorcerer. Tusks.
Yeah, and they got tusks and everything, and they're like, and I was like, we really need some fantasy world standardization here. I need to know like what I'm looking at when you tell me you've got a troll or an orc. And it's like Tolkien orcs are different from Warcraft orcs. And like a whole pile of these things are like, you know, it's hard to keep track of it.
Right.
But the thing about it is, it's I looked at Lewis and I assumed he was childish in a lot.
He is. That's like one of my favorite words to use to describe him.
Childlike might be better.
Beautifully childish. There's actually, there's an anecdote that, now these, anybody that's written a book knows that there's not like one single source that your book came from.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
But
it's a soup.
Yes. But Dumb Lewis book. Had, one, or Tolkien once said in an interview that the reason he wrote Lord of the Rings was because he was creating a language and Lewis wanted a story. Lewis always wanted a story. Yeah. And that is just the coolest thing. Like he was such a child at heart. Things didn't get old to him because he was young.
Well, he got tired of his friend listing his Wikipedia page to him and was like, look, like this is actually really, this is, right. He got bullied into writing a story because his friends got so tired of him telling him about all the cool crap he was writing. He's like, well, I've written this language and it's based loosely on Finnish and an amalgamation of Welsh, and like, put it in a story. And he's like, well, here's a poem. Five rings of Elven like under the sky. It's like, oh, that's cool. That's an
what
idea.
If I took the weird like bedtime story that I told my kids and then turned it into an epic?
Like, why not? Like, yeah.
But
yeah,
I would like to. I wasn't planning on doing this, which is why I'm holding my phone to do it. So this is the dedication from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to Lucy Barfield. My dear Lucy, I wrote this story for you. But when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound, you will be older still. But someday, you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear, and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a beautiful way of explaining like how Lewis saw fairy tales. And I love that quote, and I love that concept. And I think Lewis said it more pithily elsewhere that people grow out of fairy, or any book that is worth reading as a child is going to be worth reading again as an adult.
That's 100% true. Boomerangs around. I know, having a
you have
little
to,
boy myself, I feel it.
You have to almost go through like your like awkward teenage years, and it doesn't have to literally be your teenage years, but you have
but
to go.
It does have to be awkward.
Yes, but you have to go through sort of this sophomoric phase of thinking like, I'm too smart to like that kind of thing.
We call those the Reddit years.
You get pretty Reddity about Reddit.
Oh, dude, I get Reddity Reddity about Reddit. Gary, that's right on them. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we oftentimes in that period were mistaking cynicism for intelligence.
Yeah.
And we're throwing babies out with bathwater. I hope our culture is coming back around to a place where we appreciate fairy tales. I think there's real value in it, not only in a moral teaching kind of thing, but also just in a sense of escapism. That is part of like in On Fairy Tales, what Tolkien says in defense of them is that they're both a way to grapple with the real and escape from it for a little bit at the same time.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. There are things you can learn through a fairy story.
Yeah.
You can let the fairy story pay your dumb tax to some extent. Let them make the mistakes in the story so you can learn. I love that.
So there it is. World building before world building. Myths and fairy stories talk about a world which, to their listeners, may have been somewhat descriptive or at least informative of the world they were living in. Over time, there's been a cynicism in stories that seems to require there to be a material explanation for every element of a setting. But Dave and I are seeing a patchy resurgence that rejects this idea in favor of the fantastical. What I would say is, don't reject wonder and childlike joy as you found your settings. Allow mystery. You don't have to determine the birth rate of your Elvish population for them to feel grounded in the setting, and certainly not at the cost of wonder. If you had some strong feelings about this episode and you want to come and yell at us about it, go ahead and join the Discord server linked in the show notes. We'd love to have you in there mixing it up with us and giving your own opinion on fairy stories, myth, allegory, and world building. For Dave, I'm James, and this has been the Worldcraft Club podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
It's not a dwarf at all. Like, you're supposed to protect
you did
it.
No, you did dwarves wrong, Lewis.
Yeah, just go back and protect your garden from witches like gnomes are supposed to do.